name is William Spencer. I'm the Principal Military Specialist at the National Archives at Kew. This podcast is coming from the Imperial Museum of the North in Manchester on the centenary of the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle, which started on the 10th of March 1915. I have a number of guests with me who will introduce themselves, and then we will move on to discuss various aspects relating to the centenary of Neuve-Chapelle and various aspects of the contribution of the Indians in the First World War.
Thank you. I'm Brigadier Brian McCall. I'm the Defence Advisor in the British High Commission, New Delhi.
I'm Squadron Leader Rana Chena. I'm with the United Service Institution of India in New Delhi.
I'm Shantanu Das. I'm an academic based at King's College, London.
I'm Tony McLennigan. I'm Secretary of the Indian Military Historical Society.
Thank you. So the first question is, why is Neuve-Chapelle so important?
Well, the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle was the first battle in which the Indian Corps was engaged as a complete body. When the Indians arrived on the Western Front in the autumn of 1914, they were sent up into the front line, but essentially deployed in penny packets. And they didn't get the chance to go into action as a formed body. And Neuve-Chapelle was actually the first time that that they went into action as a complete corps in itself.
Absolutely, and I think it also was good for their morale, because for the first time that when the bombardment started at 7:35 a.m., the very fact that they advanced so fast, I was thinking particularly of the Garhwal Brigade, all four battalions kind of covering the ground, and they took the village very soon. What happened later is a different story, but the very fact that they had been so successful on the very first morning, I think that was a very important aspect for them.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was, of course, you know, the fact that they achieved their military objectives to a very large extent, and the success attached to that, I think, gave them a lot of self-confidence. It also, established themselves as professional fighting soldiers at par with the rest of the people. And I think in the long term, and in particular as far as historians are concerned, that's very important, because there was, of course, subsequently, as casualties mounted and as other problems came forth, there were certain criticisms that were levelled against the Indian Corps later on in its deployment on the Western Front. But I do think Neuve-Chapelle established that all of those criticisms were unfounded.
Absolutely, and also that they were able to take around 200 prisoners, and then I think they also captured 5 machine guns that very morning, and the fact that later communications broke down between the artillery and the infantry, that's, I think, a separate story. The very fact, as you say, it gave them a lot of confidence, which is very important after the maybe debacle at Tama.
You have an interesting point, with obviously being the regiments being put in penny packets in the autumn of 1914, and in many cases getting used to the weather on the Western Front. The fact that they endured that and then came out and illustrated that they were a very effective fighting force at the first available opportunity is a good feather in their cap. Tony?
Yeah. There may be a question as to why they hadn't been deployed earlier as a cohesive corps, and why they'd been used to fill the gap, but that was probably a necessity at the time. The British Army didn't have the numbers it needed, and the Indians, of course, had gone in as being a ready-made, ready-to-fight force, the only one available to them, and therefore they felt that they used them where they could for a period, but there had to come this time when they were used on their own or in their own right.
It's interesting, from the pre-war planning, when they obviously decided to create a number of expeditionary forces, that they brought the Indian regiments over into Marseille and then up to the Western Front, but they didn't really use them in the initial way that the pre-war planning had thought about. So consequently, you do eventually get to the evolution of them all being brought together and fighting at Neuve-Chapelle. Brigadier, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we need to bear in mind that, you know, the Indian Corps was a corps that was trained for the particular demands of India. And, you know, what we had in the autumn of 1914 was the start of, you know, horrific industrial trench warfare. So there would have been an issue that, you know, the Indian Corps was going into warfare to which they were not experienced or perhaps even practiced in. And I suspect that many historian commentators have drawn the analysis that they were needed to fill the line. And they certainly did that. And they did it, you know, with exemplary courage and valour. And as is often the case with British units, you know, you're awarded a battle honour after the event. And, you know, Neuve-Chapelle is a battle honour. You know, it's probably more important after the event than it was at the time, because it has attracted the battle honour of Neuve-Chapelle.
It's a very interesting battle from the British perspective, because they did learn a lot. And unlike later operations, they were quite quick in a way to draw a line and end the battle when they realised that they weren't going to gain much more of the German position. If we can move on, although we are here talking about the centenary of their first particular battle, where they served as a corps, what does the Indian contribution to the First World War mean to the South Asian communities, both here in Britain and back in India?
Well, the centenary commemoration, I think, it's very important from my interaction with the South Asian community in the United Kingdom as a part of the India and the Great War Centenary Commemoration Project. You know, we've been doing a lot with this over the past couple of years, both here in the United Kingdom and back home in India with Brigadier McCall and I. The realization that dawned upon me was that for the South Asian community here in Britain, it was very important to give them a sense of an identity where, you know, their history kind of overlapped with the larger history of the country that is now their own. And I think that helps in greater integration and in a greater sense of commonality, of community, and a shared history, shared past. And that's really, really very important for them. So that way, I think the whole centenary commemoration goes beyond just remembering the valor and the sacrifice of those who died. I mean, that of course is a huge part of it, but it also has a very real relevance in modern terms for people who both of South Asian origin in the United Kingdom and back in India as well. And I would just say that as far as India is concerned, it's interesting because for many years, the approach in most post-colonial states, you know, they have a bit of a problem when you look back at the colonial aspects of your history. But I do think that we have moved, we've matured sufficiently as a nation, we moved out of that colonial shadow, and we are able to re-embrace or rediscover aspects of our history which for a long time had actually been neglected, because earlier there was a kind of a feeling that, well, this is part of our colonial past, it's not really our history, but now all of that has changed and people are stepping up and saying, no, this is a part of our history, it's a very important part of our history, and it's something that we want to engage with and recall and remember just as much as the rest of the world.
And I think a point coming out of that is that for a long time this was lost sight of. The fact that India contributed had been lost sight of, not only here in the UK, but also in India, in the run-up to 2018, to the start of these commemorations, 2014, I heard exactly the sort of comment Rana was just saying, well, it was a European war. And then there was they were our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers and great-uncles who fought and died and bled the same as anybody else. And therefore, this awareness programme that started, as far as I'm concerned, back in last March with that conference in Delhi, has had a tremendous effect in kick-starting it. And we now have family members coming forward saying, I've got this that belonged to my great-granddad. I've no idea what it is. Can you tell me? And it may be a document, it may be a medal, it may be an item of uniform, but it has, if you like, generated an interest and awareness. And that's certainly coming out from comments that picking up now amongst the South Asian community here, people we were speaking to earlier today at the National Memorial Arboretum ceremony, making this sort of comment that, yeah, they do realise this is a part of history and they want to know more. They don't know it yet and they want to know more.
Yes, I think it's happening over the last maybe 5 or 6 years, because when I was growing up in India in the 70s and early 80s, I grew up on the poetry of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. I was taught nothing about the Indian contribution. So as a result, you know, my initial work is about British literature. It's only later, I guess, along with the nation, I gained more confidence to work on this. And I'm always struck by the extraordinary levels of interest and even passion that many of the British Asians have in this. And this was evident during the remarkable exhibition that the UK Punjab put up. And I think it's this excavation of memory, because it's a way of for these young people to align their contemporary identity as British Asians with perhaps what is the most defining European event of the 20th century, to say that their history did not begin with 1960s or 70s when their parents came to England, but much earlier. However, one point, and this is perhaps I'm being slightly contrary, I think this is absolutely essential to recover and remember the contribution without sanitizing the colonial experience. And I think, particularly in India, I think it's a very difficult and delicate act of balancing this full recovery and commemoration without losing sight of the colonial aspects, or without lapsing into imperial nostalgia, because that is a danger. And I think we should be wary of that as well.
Yes, I think the current government in India deserves enormous praise for being willing to acknowledge World War I in a way that previous governments of India probably haven't and probably have been reluctant to do. I think that's quite a courageous thing for the current government to do. This week, for example, there's a parade at India Gate, presidential level parade, commemorating the Indian Army's role in World War I and Nerve Chappelle itself. That would have been probably an act that would have been unheard of in previous administrations. So there's quite an awakening. And the awakening is fueled by the fact that there's a real story to be told, and it's a positive story, and it's a story of, you know, Indian soldiers on the world stage for the first time in, you know, the history of either modern India or, you know, India continent in previous centuries. Military history is often more interesting than other forms of history, because it involves emotive words like, you know, courage, valor, honor, death, destruction, tragedy. You know, these are words that by their very use engender interest, and the youth are interested in this. So there's this slow awakening across the Indian population that, yes, there is a story to be told, and let's tell it and let's listen to it. There are still dissenting voices, and that's natural, and I suspect there will always be dissenting voices. But the one thing that I detect that modern India is exceptionally pleased to see is that the UK government is acknowledging the role of the Indian servicemen in World War One. And they're also very surprised to see that the UK South Asian diaspora are also commemorating the involvement in World War One. And that means an awful lot back home.
Yes, it is. I just as a footnote to that, I'd say cultural history is equally important, if not more, because it's Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon V that first come to our mind as important as the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And it's absolutely essential, I think, to recover the cultural dimensions of the Indian war experience. We do not have an enormous amount of written material, but there are lots of songs, there's a lot of oral memory, there's a lot of artifacts. So I think we shouldn't ever lose sight of the important cultural dimensions, because all these people going to different parts of the world, resulting in an extraordinary variety of cultural encounters, and then all these people coming back home. So I think we should embed the war not just in military history, which is important, but in a much larger socio-cultural framework, so that it affects the entire population, not just the people who went and fought.
So, following on from what the Brigadier said about stories to be told, how are archives and the materials that they hold being used to explore some of these stories and to commemorate India's contribution to the First World War today?
Well, you know, when Rana and I decided to embark on a project of commemoration, the first thing that Rana said to me was, you know, of course, Brian, what you've got to bear in mind is, you know, you Britishers have all the war diaries. To which I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you took them in 1947 and you haven't given them to us. So perhaps the best thing you could do as part of commemorations would be to actually present the war diaries to us. And that's where the National Archives have come in. So what we have done so far is we have digitized and printed and bound the war diaries for the regiments in the original India Corps, and we have presented those. There are numerous other theatres and campaigns. The Indian Army was unique that it fought in almost every campaign in the First World War, and there's further work to be done. But that's just one side of it. You know, there's British Library, there's National Army Museum and all the rest of it. And Rana has far more ins into the archive situation in the UK than I will ever have. So Rana, over to you.
Yes, of course, one of the major problems that I think anybody, well, any researcher faces in any subject is access to archive and material. In particular, when you come to dealing with India and the First World War, the bulk of the records actually formed a part of what were then called the War Branch of the Military Department. And I am afraid it would appear that a very, very large portion of those records were destroyed at partition, because they just... you find the index volumes, and there are these huge, thick printed index volumes which go into enormous detail. And once you look at those index volumes, you know, you're kind of in raptures of ecstasy, saying, oh my God, this is fantastic. When you actually requisition for those records, they're just not there. But the records, of course, as the Brigadier just mentioned, we have the war diaries of the units, which are available at the National Archives in Kew. There are a number of records which are part of the India Office Library and records in the British Library. We have records in the National Archives in New Delhi. I think some of those records are also available in the UK, but we do have the printed war diaries of the various theatres and the higher formations and so on and so forth. I know that the Australian War Memorial has a number of war diaries and a number of India-related records with them. By and large, I should think... And then, of course, you know, the regiments and units in India and Pakistan still hold things like digests of service, regimental scrapbooks, albums, and so on and so forth. But that would really be you know, the extent of the records. Tony, of course, has been working on the Indian States Forces, the Imperial Service Troops, as they were known.
Yes.
And he would have some sense of...
Well, there's a tremendous run of war diaries of the princely states and their contribution in the National Archives at Kew. And a plug for it is it's so easy to access. So it's a delight to go there and draw on it. Nevertheless, the cautionary tale, as we all know from war diaries, depending on who was tasked to fill it out, and whether he'd had a bad hair day or not, determines what goes in it. And so they can be very full, and we recently worked on 15 Sikhs, and that was an incredible war diary.
Yes.
But I've looked at others where I know full well there was a specific event took place on that day, and it doesn't even get a mention. So this is down to the guys on the day, you know, having to fill the thing out last thing at night before they crash out, and they're variable in their content. But, yeah, I think the point that Rana made also, though, is they are well spread around. Yes, Kew has quite a lot. The British Library, India Office Library and Records Park, has some. National Archive in Delhi has some. But there's other stuff that's spread around. So as a researcher, it can be an incredibly long, drawn-out process to find what you're looking for. And somewhere, someone's sitting on that little golden nugget that you desperately want to find.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because also I think that these diaries are very, very important, but I think at the same time we also need to go beyond the diaries and look at a wider variety of things, such as objects, the sound recordings at the Humboldt Collection in Berlin, photographs. There are hundreds of photographs at different archives in France, in England, in Germany, even in the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. Paintings, sketches, and I'll just give you two examples, because often they recover intimate histories, not regimental histories, but I think they are very important. Like a few years back, almost 8 years back, in a tiny archive in Chandannagar, which was a former French colony in West Bengal, I came across a pair of broken and bloodstained glasses belonging to someone called Jogensen, John Sen, and further research revealed that he was the only non-white member of the Leeds Pals Battalion, and it's an unusual case because he was in the Yorkshire Regiment, not part of the Indian Corps. And I think the piecing together of just one life story among 1 million, I think it is quite interesting. And also, as the Brigadier says, I think we need good stories. They are very helpful. And I'll just tell you one story. I know Rana has a whole fund of stories from his own family. I'll just say one. In my family, one of my great uncles, he served as a doctor in France, Prashant Kumar Guho. He was there for 6 years, and his younger brother at that time, he was called Bande Mataram, Hail to the Mother, nationalist brother. He was locked up in a colonial jail and then beaten to death. And in the same family, we have one person serving the empire, and the other being a nationalist and a revolutionary nationalist. And I think it's a homage, I'd say, to the complex and contradictory histories of India, which we should acknowledge during the centennial years.
Well, thank you very much. Does anybody have any closing comments they may wish to make? Rana?
Well, as I mentioned right at the beginning, we've been engaged with the India and the Great War Centenary Commemoration Project. And that's a project which is being done jointly by the United Service Institution of India, along with the Government of India Ministry of External Affairs. And the project really operates at two levels. One is the popular, and the other is the academic. And bearing in mind the kind of the points which I think Shantanu made, which are very, very relevant, the idea was not to, to have a purely military approach towards the centenary, the commemoration, but to have a more holistic approach that looked at the way in which, not just the way in which India. The role that India played in the war, but the way in which the war impacted India, both in terms of its political impact, its cultural impact, the social impact, all of that. So we are trying to look at it as holistically as possible, including the very, very important aspects of recovering of these cultural histories, the songs, the recruiting ditties, and the most exciting, as far as we are concerned, as far as the project is concerned, I think the things which we managed to unearth are the personal writings, whether they are diaries, autobiographies, or recorded interviews, and so on and so forth, of Indian soldiers. And these are literally worth their weight in gold, because unlike in Europe, where you know you had so many people wrote about their war experience, the Indian voice has been almost totally missing from this huge mass of literature that you have about the First World War. And as Shantanu pointed out, of course, there is that fantastic archive, sound archive in Berlin. But the stuff that we managed to uncover, I think, is very, very fascinating. And the project, of course, it's not just what we managed to do till date. And last year we had a very, very successful a joint event, which was done, Brigadier and I organized that at the British High Commission in Delhi. And there were a number of things which we did. Maybe Brian can quickly talk about some of those. But we also want to continue over the next 4 years and keep up the momentum as far as the community outreach goes, as well as generating certain really important academic research out of the whole thing.
Yeah, with the event we ran last year, we were able to present digitized war diaries. We were able to present hard copy bound war diaries to the colonels of the regiments. We presented or unveiled a commemorative coffee table book that Rana had produced himself, a battlefield guidebook for families wishing to do a pilgrimage trip back to France and Flanders. And we also unveiled sandstone memorials to the VC winners, as well as a commemorative plaque listing the VC winners from the government of the UK. So it was a hugely successful event that attracted considerable media attention, and it's really kick-started the whole project.
That sounds absolutely wonderful, and I think a lot of maybe more enduring and academic work will be coming in the next few years, because I think the first year is pretty important in creating the interest, and that interest has now been created. And I've been working on it for a long time, and in fact I'm doing a book called India and the First World War: Objects, Images, Words and Music, because I think we need a dialogue between these four things, which will be out from Cambridge next year. But I've just done a coffee table book about pictures, because I think, as Rana was saying, one of the problems we have is that we do not have that abundance of literary records. So hopefully we'll be at a very different point in 2018 when the voice of the Indian achievements would be heard more widely.
The challenge, I think, is to remember that we're talking about what was then undivided India. So in fact, we're talking about regiments that are now scattered, and we have to be able to capture the undivided Indian contribution.
Thank you very much. Let's hope that those who may listen to this podcast may come forth with more stories, and then we may be able to help tell a much more detailed and personal picture of India's contribution to the First World War than that so far achieved. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.